Confusion matrix.
There's always an apocalypse to end an episode with, isn't there? It's not a good day if you haven't conceived of a new apocalypse. So, we are rolling. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
Yes, I'm very good. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. The weather continues to be bleak in Scotland, which is exactly how it should be. And I'm nice and cool for a change.
Yes, it's heading into that part of the year.
Yes, it is. It is indeed. So, we've done our customary British weather chat. So let's just pile into what we're going to talk about today, which is vibe coding again. I'm going to state for the record as we start this conversation that I no longer agree with or wish to use the term vibe coding, and we can talk about that if you want. I think it's a pejorative term that I think it needs to be binned already, having only really recently been coined. I think broadly speaking, we mean using AI to write code. So we're going to have to figure out how to say that without using the V word. I think we've got a few different angles and perspectives on this. When we talked about this prior to recording, we have such a large amount to say on it and a whole bunch of adjacent topics. I'm not even going to try and list them. We're just going to pile in a starting point that's somewhat arbitrary and see where it takes us. And I have every expectation this will run into more than one episode. So prepare yourself, people, strap in, because it's going to be epic. So where do we want to start? How do we want to frame this? Got any thoughts?
Well, really, for me, it's a discussion of, with the foibles that we know of, and we've covered a couple of episodes around testing and the non-deterministic nature of these models. And it's easy to fall into the sort of head scratcher, pull my hair out and go, well, it's just not going to be any good, because these things, you know, they're always going to come up with a different answer, and trying to productionize that is just going to be a complete nightmare. But something which vibe coding stumbles into and is coined around is the idea that if you're using the models to produce something for you, then you can have the discerning eye over it. And so a bit like you would, you know, people talk about using these things like an intern. You ask somebody to do something for you or you know, formally delegate a work, and that person goes and does it for you. And when it comes back, it might not be perfect, but it might be good enough. And then you go through some iterations to improve it either with them or without them. And I feel like that's where these systems are going. And we sort of termed the phrase personalized software, because you can get something coded up via an AI quite quickly. It's going to have problems. But the big question is, how much does that matter to you as the person on the receiving end of it, knowing exactly what you want it to do? And obviously, this is where you've been for the last few months, really driving out some of your code for Taco and OCAT, and you know, putting up with where there are problems and then working through where it's not good enough.
Indeed, right. And so I think we need to sort of draw a distinction here, and also somewhat describe the attitudes to using AI to write code, where it's clearly problematic and where it's less so, right? And so in a situation where you work for, you know, Pete's Digital Systems with a bunch of other coders in your AI startup, whatever it is, your mobile phone app, gaming company, blah, 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 whatever it is, you're writing code, there's a group of you doing it, and you have a large mature code base that is stable to the point where you're, you know, you have a customer base and they're reasonably happy, blah, 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 right? Very, very, very common scenario. And so you've been using all the standard tooling, it's all written in Python, whatever, with Git, and you've got process, and maybe it's even open sourced. Doesn't sort of matter for this point, but or in fact, you could cast this entire scenario into an open source world where you have an app that is published on GitHub and is fully open sourced and has a developer community. Same, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you went in there now and started writing code and got an AI to code up for a bug fix or a new feature or whatever, you pick something off the to-do list and then you send in a pull request or you check your code in, whatever you're doing, without really checking what was done by the AI. So you've tested it, it works, it achieves the goal you set out to achieve. You've eyeballed the code, it looks reasonable, or maybe you didn't even. You were like, right, done, that took me 3-4 minutes. I'm going to commit it, you know, pull request. And what's happening a lot, I think, for people, for senior developers and people who run open source code bases is that they're having to reject things that have clearly come in either via experienced developers using AI or inexperienced developers using AI because the code quality is so poor and there are clear and obvious holes or problems with it. It's not been thought through. It's just bad, right? It's just bad piece of code. So it might achieve the goal, but it achieves it badly. Now, I think it's a fairly facile example and software development isn't really that simple. Which feeds further into that problem. But you can see here where a lot of senior and career programmers are starting to see more and more complete trash code that's clearly been generated by AI and looking at this and going, no, AI is a sketch, right? This is a nightmare. I'm now spending countless hours having to reject pull requests from half-assed jobs done by AI, right? And when I try and write it myself, I find the AI code has so many problems with it, I have to reject it because it's not up to the standards that I have, right?
Yeah.
This is where a lot of the negativity is coming from. And when people say, don't use AI for coding, no vibe coding here, only humans code, blah, 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 I have sympathy for that point of view.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for it. And I think if you go back in through the history of this podcast to the earlier days, we were very much in that camp. This is going to lead to some sort of coding apocalypse if it's not monitored very closely. So I just wanted to set out the stall to say, right, that's not what we're talking about. We'll come to what we're talking about. But before we get into that, I think we need to state that, you know, we're still in that camp. I have one foot in that camp, right? That's clearly problematic. Do you have any thoughts on that before we get on to personalized software?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think you can extrapolate that that definition there to anything. It doesn't have to be code. You know, if you start thinking of less code-oriented examples, which might be, you know, copywriting or producing marketing materials. And I think what it alludes to is if you want the models to produce high quality work in any discipline of which you have probably many constraints, a high level of expertise and experience, either personally or as a group, and you you're expecting a model to produce something as good as what you or your team would produce, I think you're always going to be disappointed. And you know, and that's exactly what you're saying there. You need your productionized code. We can't let in any old stuff. Needs to meet, you know, probably a list of 100 plus criteria if you broke it out. And they're just not doing that. And, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, the models are running off, you know, the average of human experience. And so if you're not experienced in marketing material and you say, oh yeah, send me some messages for my, you know, my ice cream shop, and it comes up with 5 bullet points, and you go, oh, yeah, not bad. Yeah, great. If you're a marketing professional, you're probably binning those and moving on immediately. And it's just, I think those two things are just how it is. So if you have less experience, this stuff seems great. And, you know, it's actually a good starting point. If you're the expert, I think you're pretty much always going to feel like it's not quite up to scratch. And why wouldn't it be? Well, because it's taking the average of all humans. And if you're an expert in something, you're by definition above average.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, you know, there's the question is, okay, well, it's average, but it got me from A to B quicker, i.e. I had it write this thing, whatever it is. This thing is substandard, but it took me half an hour to edit it and fix it. When the whole process would have taken me 2 hours, it only took me half an hour, right? So there is a middle ground. I think there is mountains of pushback from that simply because I don't think it tends to work that way, and certainly not with code, right? It's rarely that simple, right?
Yeah.
And also, I think, you know, if you like writing code or you like writing copy, you'd rather spend your time doing that than checking someone else's bad work. I think we've always, whether we knew it or not, had a foot in both camps here, right? Because as we've stated, we're sympathetic to that, and we, you know, we've experienced problems with that in our, you know, in our day-to-day dealings. But we, as what we would broadly term data scientists or analysts, are very much in the habit of writing temporary or throwaway code, right? Because a lot of what we do doesn't ever need to be repeated, or it's created along a path of exploration where we absolutely did not know where we were heading, because it was a exploratory analysis. So there's lots of blind alleyways, and there's no sense in us trying to code something perfectly when it might be a blind alleyway and we'll have to throw that code away, right? Or just ignore it. And, you know, sometimes you end up writing something good, whatever. The point is, it's not, we don't put the same level of rigor into our exploratory style coding, because it's just a waste of time and effort. And when you reach some sort of endpoint, especially if that endpoint needs to either be, you know, have very, very solid reproducible results, or needs to be reused, of course we're going to tighten that right up, right? So yeah. I think the idea of writing code that is substandard is part of our daily activity. We know it's substandard. I sort of don't want people looking at my Jupyter notebooks for any exploratory analysis, because they're a bit embarrassing. But it's like, you know, the first scribbled draft you've done of some piece of poetry that you're writing, right? You don't want people looking at that shit. You know what I mean? It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's riddled with typos and some really, really awful rhymes, right? And it's the same with code, right? This is not for you. I didn't write this for you. I wrote this for me, from getting to A to B. By the time I pass my code base over to you, I've tightened it up, right? But even then, it's still transitory. So I think habitually, we are people who can accept substandard code in certain situations, and do so. I would argue that something ridiculous, like 80% of my code, I would look at after the fact and go, yeah, that was shite, but it got the job done, right? And then I knew I was going to throw it away.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And this is the whole proof of concept thing, which again, you know, we're talking specifically about code here, but extrapolates into to many disciplines, which is, you know, can you prove the value of a process you're talking about by cobbling something together. And the aim of cobbling something together, be it a process, a number of steps, you know, a model for a building or anything like that. You know, it's not the end result. It's to show it can be done. And once people have bought into that or not, the job of that thing is finished. And then there's a new job, which is why I had to be translating this to the real thing. So again, we're used to that proof of concept and proving value and doing whatever it takes to get that up and running and showing it can be done in a realistic manner. Turning that from showing a bunch of people in a room to having it, you know, used by tens of thousands of people is a different endeavor.
Well, it is, and you can look at it from you know, my other hat as an artist. These are just the sketches, right? These are the studies you do as you're, you know, creating that huge Renaissance, you know, biblical masterpiece. Go look at all the little scribbles that Michelangelo or Da Vinci or Botticelli did. Yeah, they're pretty good sketches, but they're sketches. These are not, those weren't made to be stapled onto the roof of the Sistine Chapel. So it's all part of the process. We're good, right? We're good with this, right? So I think where this brings me is to where I got to in the fact that I'm really not very squeamish about crap code, right? I recognize it. I don't like it where it doesn't belong. But I don't mind seeing it, and I'm not offended by it. It has its purpose. And I think when I started delving into the practice formerly known as vibe coding, I started to find it really very natural. But knowing full well that these things that I was creating. So originally I had Taco, which was my AI chat app, a command line AI chat app, and then its successor, OCAT, which is the same thing, only better, right? And it's, I think earlier on in that process, I sort of was half thinking about these things as something that could be, you know, open sourced and other people could work on it, because that's the habit. You know, that's the habit you get into. And this idea that, you know, everyone seems to have is that, you know, every piece of code matters. Every working application has a purpose. And you have to commit, and publish, or die, because the more important component of their visible experience is the projects that they've contributed to, the amount of GitHub commits that they've got, and so on. And we get this idea that everyone thinks that not only is every line of code important, that every five lines of code is the seed of a next unicorn startup, right? And I'll point you to a recent episode of Data Science at Home with a very, very erudite gentleman called Francesco Gadaletta, who waxes lyrical on this over various episodes recently. Bits of it I do and don't agree with, but he does state the problem quite well, and I won't repeat it. I still felt that draw when I first started doing this, and it took a little while for me to sort of beat that out of me. And actually, it took me N hours, like literally 5 or 6 hours, to develop the first iterations of this little app. And actually, you could have done exactly the same thing. And Joe Bloggs, who lives next door, could have done the same thing. And if you've got a sense that you know how to instruct these things, and you've got a reasonable idea of what you want, and you're fairly methodical about it, you can produce some very well honed applications for your own use that may be very idiosyncratic to you, might be a little bit rough around the edges and a little bit quirky in places, and might have some absolute horror show coding in it. But it works, and it works fine. Right. And maybe it was just for one job, or maybe it's for something you're going to use, like a productivity app. OCAT is actually available on GitHub. If you want to go look at it, I've not really looked at the code. It functions well for me with a few bugs that I'm you know, slowly ironing out, or rather one or more of the models is. And what I've built there is, you know, I guarantee that someone else installs it and goes, what is this, right? This isn't doing what I want at all. Why don't I have an option to do this? Why can't I change the color scheme? Why does this tool look half finished? Why does this functionality do something so completely bizarre? Why your internal shortcuts make no fucking sense? Well, you're quite welcome to have those criticisms, but I don't give a shit, right? It works for me, and it was developed for me in a way that suits me, right? And so what is that? That's a piece of personalized software I built for myself, and I will continue to iterate. And so do I care that it might have some horror show coding? Only in the sense that might make it harder to extend, build upon, you know, debug the code. But I don't care otherwise. You know, do I care that the functionality is probably a bit bizarre if you're not me? Or maybe it isn't. Maybe it's perfect, but I assume that other people want other things. Am I going to account for that? No, I'm not. I don't give a crap. Fork it and do it yourself, right? Yeah. Or start again. just fire up an AI agent and start coding your own version. You don't have to have anything to do with mine, but it's there if you want to have a look. And that's the crux of this for me. We've sort of come on a bit of a journey there in terms of from, you know, code is important and has to be stable and correct and functional to, well, if it's only you that's using it, who the fuck cares? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's worth digging into that. What does it mean if it's only you that's using it? And, you know, what's the difference between that and lots of people using it? And you talked about the different bits there. One of them is, one, what it's even designed to do is specifically for you, of which, you know, there may be, there's a Venn diagram here. And so you against average Joe is going to be a lot of overlap. And then there's also quite a few bits which other people are going to go down, you know, I don't want that, not bothered about it, et cetera. And so those bits are in there which sort of personalize it to you. Now, there's another aspect which is, well, it works, yeah, and this is where we get into the age-old software. And personally, what we mean by that is, well, I want it to do a job. From what I can see what it's doing it well enough. I've got, you know, as a human, I bring my own kind of level of quality assurance without even realizing it. So the moment I look at something, I'm already thinking, oh, is that what I want? Is that good enough? Could it be better? You know, and you've probably only looked at it for like a tenth of a second. And already those thoughts are all piling into your brain. And so there's definitely a danger here that those errors are unseen. And so, you know, especially if you're getting out calculations, et cetera, and it was producing the wrong numbers and you thought they were right, obviously that's going to be problematic. Hopefully you would see those, but I think we've all been in places where we, you know, just think of something like a spreadsheet where you're doing something, you think it's right, produces the wrong number, and you don't notice for a long time. But I mean, that's just the way some things are. But if you're, so there, that issue exists. But then there are the more obvious errors, you know, perhaps low quality or one number being really wrong, but all the others being roughly right. And as an individual, you can decide if that's an acceptable amount of error and go, oh, that's fine. And again, there's a Venn diagram between individuals where a whole bunch of people might say, yeah, that's acceptable. But someone might have a higher or lower tolerance. And I certainly remember having this, you know, when you do code walkthroughs and so forth many years ago, and you know, as a group, you're trying to say, is this code good enough for production? And some people are really picky around, yeah, but the rules say, you know, it's got to have this in there, and you've not named it like that. You haven't got an underscore. You know, it doesn't affect the end game of the code, but someone's pernickety about it, and everyone's putting their hair out, you know. So there's those differences between people. And I think the personalization side means that you get to decide how good this needs to be without it being thrust upon you, which of course creates a whole new set of issues. But I think it's a valid thing to be working with. I mean, we all do it as part of our everyday jobs and everyday life, where you get something from somebody else or even a past self that you've done something earlier in the week and you come back to it and you go, yeah, that's fine, I'll go with that, or it's not good enough, I need to work on it some more. So I think there's that side of it. And again, you must have, you must be aware of yourself making these decisions over good enough or not good enough as it produces the code for you.
Well, yeah, it's good enough for me. And we can move outside of the conversation about code immediately, right? I don't look at it, right? Why did I go from TACO to OCAT? What is OCAT? So just to be very clear, TACO was a command line LLM interface that allowed me to just have chats. And the reason I produced it, because every time I got someone else's client, it had weirdnesses that I didn't like, or it wanted to do this and that and the other, or I wouldn't do a thing that I wanted. And every one of them had something I didn't quite gel with. And I just got bored with it and was like, well, I'm just going to write my own, right? So I just got up, probably it was GPT-10 or something to write it. But because I had no real sense of where I was going with it, you know, started off as a bit of a one script Python thing, and then quickly mutated into a package and an executable and all this stuff. It's all still in Python, but I was just adding to it. It was using some of the earlier models that was less capable at coding. And after a couple of weeks of using this and trying to get it to do more and more stuff and adding more and more features that I wanted, it really started to creak. It started to take ages to boot up. The models couldn't figure out what to do with the code. And then I went into it and started looking at a few bits and pieces and noted that, and there's a prior episode on me getting really quite shirty about this, that the models are putting big try except clauses around huge chunks of code, which is like, I don't care what side of this code argument you're on here, you don't do that, right? And so I realized that there were so many problems in that code base. And when I did a pattern find on the whole code base, I find lots of this, right? Lots of bare try except loops around, large chunks of code. I was like, well, this is irredeemable, right? This code base has now become so tired and it's got so much technical debt that there's no point in trying to fix it. So I just had it recode it. And as opposed to try and recode from the same base, I just started from scratch. And therefore we have OCAT, which is TACO reverse engineered, which is probably, again, not strictly what I did, but close enough. And it was written by one of the more modern models, and actually has been really stable now for a couple of months. I keep adding to it. It's got productivity stuff in there. I keep my whole to-do lists in there. It does reminders for me. Everything gets stored in a vector store. It does sort of real-time RAG-type activity, sending, snippets of prior conversation up with new stuff so the models have context, all this stuff, blah, 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 right? And so it does matter whether the code is bad because of these problems with technical debt. But it took me, the first iteration of OCAT took me less, I'd had it done in less than 24 hours. And most of the effort I spent doing it was writing a new prompt, going through what TACO did, making some caveats in it so it didn't make some of the same mistakes, and adding some bits and removing some bits and so on that I wanted, and then got it to run with it, right? Told it to break it down into chunks and code it. But I haven't looked at the code of OCAT. I haven't. Mm. I mean, I haven't not definitely not looked at any of it, but I've not spent any time trying to figure out how it works. I see the structure of the project. It looks pretty sane based on my understanding of what a good project looks like. It's very pedestrian. It's not doing anything particularly exciting. I've had a few code hiccups where some of the engineering in it was a bit off, or some of its interpretations of my requirements were a little bit creative in the wrong direction. But they've been fairly easy to fix. I'm aware of some structural issues in there that I'm looking at suspiciously going, this is not so clever, might cause me some trouble, right? But from that perspective, I largely don't care. I very rarely think about this because it really works well for me, right? And to the point now where I'm like, I don't really want to do much coding on it in case I break it, right? I kind of like it because it's not just that whether or not it codes it badly, it's whether I ask it to do something and then really I don't like that, right? And then this is my productivity software. The other sort of trade-off with things like personalized software is I don't have a really robust release process and stuff like that. So I'll often accidentally, you know, completely bollocks up my working version, right?
Yeah.
But who's hurting then, right? You know, quarter of a million customers or just little old me, right? Who's gonna discipline me? Well, I get disciplined because it doesn't bloody work, right? And that really annoys me. But outside of it, no one cares. And for the most part, I don't worry about any of it. It just, does it work? Does it do what I want? And as you point out, yes, there are problems because I've had issues where it wasn't saving bits of chats, for example. And that's pretty silent until you want to go back and see that chat you had with it 2 days ago and it's not there. But those problems are annoying, right? But there's nothing critical going on here. I didn't tell it to remember something that if I wasn't somehow able to retrieve, that some part of my life was going to be in horrible peril, because I'm not going to do that. I don't trust it to that level because it wasn't... That's not my specification. I don't need it to be completely perfect because that's not what it's for.
Well, I think that's not what it's for. And therefore, the space that these things fill, I think, is really interesting because and as you were talking there, I really liken it to, you know, really useful tools, which we come back to again and again, something like Excel, because the way you were speaking, I could almost... just to inserted Excel into what you were saying about, you know, OCAT and generated software. And what you're saying is, well, you know, I'm just using this tool here. It's good enough for what I use it for. It's not critical. And I've built it up. And then you would have been using it 6 months. And like Excel tools, they're not critical until they're critical, right? Because everyone thinks they're just using them personally. And then someone else says, oh, it's quite good. And they copy that and we do this. And then next thing you know, it is suddenly on the critical path and we sort of didn't realize, and then something goes wrong and then it's all much worse than we originally thought. And it's easy to get there because you're incrementally doing something a little bit more useful, You're not approaching this from a point of view of, oh, you know, I'm trying to solve the biggest problem in the world here, right? So I really need to make sure that this process that I'm putting in is airtight. Actually, starting right from the other end is I just need to do this little bit of the process. And if I can have something which helps me, that makes the whole thing better, you know, which is exactly where Excel comes in. You know, I just needed to do a few numbers for me. Oh, well, that's quite good. Oh, well, maybe I can just automate that. Or maybe I can just get these numbers put in automatically here, start adding these things in. And slowly it builds out. And, you know, you add in another tab and so on and so forth. And then when you're 2 years down the line, you look back and think, yeah, I wouldn't have done it this way if I'd have started with my problem statement first. But you're never going to. And also, I think this is a completely valid way of working. And I think more important than it, whether it's valid or invalid, is going to happen because these tools provide that level of usefulness when you're not thinking of trying to solve the whole problem. And the fact that they can interlink and, you know, form a part of the process means that down the line, we are going to start to see them piling up, and, you know, and there are going to be some horror stories. But, you know, as a whole sort of, it's almost like a return on investment argument, is the positives you get at putting in small solutions to problems which really help out, that the positives you get kind of outweigh the negative that comes along every now and again, you know, and as you found, you get it to produce something for you. And if there's a really key part of that which doesn't work, like your arrow up to get the previous command, well, you can only put up with that for about half a day before that needs a fix. So, you know, the really annoying things, you know, get dealt with pretty quickly. And then it's the sort of more hidden ones which stay around and, you know, come back and haunt us. But I think it's a completely valid way of working. And where my head is at is, you know, this is what's happening right now. And I don't see it stopping. I don't see anyone's going to be able to say, oh, yeah, you know, don't do this. It's a bad idea, because these, you know, getting code generated for you for specific problems, which helps you in your daily role or regular tasks, why wouldn't you do that? It makes no sense to deliberately not solve that problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, even while you were explaining all that about Excel, it is an analog, and you just see this bleeding into, while I'm using it here for my, you know, personal use, I could use that for this job I've got to do at work, and suddenly someone else is using it, and as you point out, suddenly, you know, it's some weird part of some mission critical piece of business process, and we've all seen that happen, and I think there's a buyer beware aspect to this, and anyone who installs OCAT and uses that and somehow is relying on it, especially if they're taking updates and stuff, more for you. Just don't do that, right? I mean, it's not built for that. I mean, I could. A part of me was like, I should just probably pull it down, right? But it's there because, you know, I talk about it on here. I don't mind people looking at it. I don't care what people's opinions on it are. It is sort of a useful thing to have out there. And plus, it's, you know, I'm getting some GitHub stats from it and stuff. It's fine, but don't bloody build that into some mission critical part of your world. I mean, this is not supported. I mean, the same goes for any open source software, for example. And, you know, and so I think that's not a new problem. I think it's going to be made worse by the fact that people can vibe code, you know, at any time they like? Well, actually, I absolutely do. And it's the people who don't understand the boundaries of those domains. It's the use cases where people think, well, I can build this little app that just does this thing and it handles my credit cards. Or, you know, I've built my own password manager because the one that's in my browser doesn't work properly. It's like, no, don't do that, right? And suddenly someone's doing it in the workplace and they've created some things, a little productivity tool that was dealing with some you know, customer data on their local hard drive, which is surreptitiously, you know, passing it to their Dropbox in the background in an unsecured area and stuff. It's like, why is it doing that? Well, I just told it to do something with this, right? And I wanted to make sure it was backed up, so it backed it up to my Dropbox, right? And suddenly you're like, wait, that's PII data. Why did you do that? where they probably wouldn't have done before, right? I'm just making random, spitballing random examples here. But I can see the problem is, I think, where we are responsible developers, and all development is data now, right? And so, you know, responsibly handling data is part of our day jobs and our responsibility, and our is legally necessary, right? And
yeah.
And therefore, what goes in to and from OCAT is random conversations about, you know, the best way to organise my Linux apps and my to-do list, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how is that accessed? It's accessed over SSH, right? Because everything's done on the terminal. You know, it's as secure as it needs to be. And I'm quite fastidious about not letting it get access to anything else. Because yes, things can go horribly wrong here. But there's the trade-off, isn't it? Right? Well, since you built this one bad Excel spreadsheet that did a dodgy calculation that led to someone making a bad decision, all Excel's banned. Soz. Right?
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to happen, is it? Right? So the question isn't, should people be able to, allowed to, or encouraged to do this? Well, no, it's always the same, isn't it? It's about education.
Yeah, education and diligence in using. And this is where we, you know, hit, I think, a really important point, which is, you know, basically the corporate versus the individual. And, you know, in the same way that's happened in the last 20 years since the advent of the internet, really, is people end up doing stuff first before it appears in the corporation. And it always used to be the other way around. But now, because we have these platforms, and now because the sort of cost of entry, if you like, of having code and producing code is just being pushed down to sort of near zero, and it can run on anything. Oh, it can run on your phone, it can run on a tablet, everyone's got a home PC, you know, whatever. And now I can get this application working that's pulling in data from anywhere, which I don't need to have access to on my, you know, my own personal stuff. It just gives me the answers. It's showing me stuff. All of that is coming down, making it really easy to produce an application, which, of course, 30 years ago, well, you know, you didn't have a phone in your pocket, et cetera, et cetera. And now you do. And so corporations have for some time now been quite behind. And I think what they've got to be looking at here is seeing that this stuff is going to be coming. And like you say, we've got to be thinking about, okay, well, how do we run these applications? Not how do we run this specific application that Alex has got, but how do we make it safe for him to run and make sure that our structural software, if you like, is monitoring to the point where data isn't being siphoned off into, you know, outside the company, as a very good example, I think. And, you know, it gives room for new generated code to run, but somehow is just making sure it doesn't, you know, step over the mark. And I think that really the emphasis is on, you know, probably corporate IT to say, well, look, guys, you've got to come up with the tools and the sandboxes and the infrastructure for this stuff to run in. Don't try and create the software that's going to run, because you're never going to be able to do that. And that's like, you know, that's always, it's like IT trying to take over the world, you know, run projects. Yeah, it's a great idea, except for when you realize that any one company is probably going to have 20,000 plus projects. There just aren't enough people in the world to do that. So the fact that these guys are running something on Excel, well, you're just going to have to leave it, because yes, we should automate that. Yes, it should become, you know, industrial strength. And though we don't have the people or the money to do that. And I think it's going to be the same here is, yeah, in an ideal world, corporate would control all of the new systems being built. But the fact of the matter is, especially when they've been knocked out in a matter of hours, which before would have taken people weeks and would have taken an IT department years. I mean, you're talking about producing, you know, you could have a team producing a new system, three or four new systems a week. I mean, there's no way any IT department is going to be able to write and keep up with that. So you've got to just say, well, here's the place where you put these systems. And we'll have a bunch of monitors that make sure that the, you know, inputs and outputs are monitored, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's really where they need to be looking to spend their time, because I think this stuff is going to explode. And if companies don't do it, we're going to be back into the same thing where we've been for the last 20 years, which is if the big company doesn't do it, the little startup's going to do it. Why? Well, because it started off with three people and they were just knocking out this software, and someone said, oh, that's a good service, and they went and bought that service. Next thing you know, this little company with six people has now got, you know, $100 million valuation, and loads of companies are using that service. And the traditional company that offers that service are going, well, why aren't we doing that? And the answer is, well, because you've got too many barriers, because you don't want to do it because it's too dangerous and you're not flexible enough. And it'll be the small guys who build out of nothing that then come and provide that service.
And so, well, and a couple of MBAs do it rather than actual, you know, experienced software developers, right? And then hit all the types of problems they're going to have. And I think, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And the implications in every direction are quite staggering. And I think people focus, there's all sorts of problems with the AI industry, if you can even call it that, in the way that people are thinking about Gen AI, particularly language models and how to deploy them. I think they're looking in the wrong direction. I think that there is a revolution. It is happening. It is going to come. Some of it will look like what the doomsayers have been saying. But I think that a lot of people are focusing on the moped that's careering down the road that's going to hit them, and getting out of the way of that and not noticing the bloody juggernaut that's coming down the other side of the intersection, which is going to slam into them in a much, much more scary way, right? And also, the tendrils of the implication of this spread out in so many different directions. And so I think I agree with you. And in fact, this conversation has swung me back a bit in the cynical direction, simply because you're right. Actually, can I be disciplined enough to keep this contained and within domains I realise I can control, being a responsible and half-decent software developer? I like to think so, right? So let's just say I can keep my discipline and do that. Can the next person along that is less experienced or not experienced at all, who just sees the facility of these things and the power that they can wield by coding out applications, do whatever they want, shortcuts of things and so on, how can we put that particular genie back in the bottle, right? Should those people be doing that? Well, I'm actually thinking, well, less so. Do I trust myself to be responsible here? Yes, I do. Do I trust anyone else to be responsible with it? Well, obviously not, right? And that's going to open, you know, one can of worms, Pandora's box, genies out of lamps, whichever one you want, right? But then the other side to it for me, which I think is where you see yourself as a group of people jostling on the road, watching the moped coming down the line at them, right? And the other people in the road are people like you, but they're also the people who are delivering these products, these models, right? The people working in Silicon Valley to develop solutions around technology, either more mature or startup mentality, are all stood in the road with us, and we're all looking at the moped. And what staggers me the greatest amount is that these models, if we really do get an AI coding frenzy and this level of people flooding in and creating their own solutions, well, what have I got? I've got a to-do list in OCAT, right? Now I don't need Todoist or one of the other third-party companies that charge subscriptions for that, right? I wasn't using one anyway, so I'm not a good example here, but I have done in the past, and I have paid for them. Now, mine is distributed. I can access it on my phone. I can access it from anywhere, right? So it's not about that, right? And I don't want to get into the specifics here, but my point being is that that's one function. I'm now one non-customer where there would be a subscription customer potentially, right? And there's lots and lots of use cases like this that people like me are going to start building out our own bespoke solutions for, which is one less subscriber. It's one less customer, right? And so we got a whole ecosystem that is... is being drained of customers by these AI models. In the meantime, the only way that a lot of these AI providers are going to be able to get real money, because there is still no consumer proposition here, right, is that they have to be charging third parties to use the model and to resell the value of those models and so on. But these companies are going to be starved of money because there's going to be less and less uptake of their software because people can build the software themselves. And the same goes for creative things as well, right? And so I don't see who they think, if their models are shutting down whole business lines, that those are customers that are now not there for the models themselves, right?
Yeah.
And coding trajectory on OCAT, was hugely spike at the front, but has now diminished to almost zero, right? Because I don't want to touch it. It's nice and stable, and most of the problems have been accounted for, right? So they're not now making, the model company's not making money out of me. So probably OpenAI benefited the most from OCAT, right? And now Todoist and all the other companies now have a potential customer that no longer exists, right? So everyone's lost, right? And who's focusing on that apocalypse? I mean, I hear Ed Zitron better offline. I agree with a good 80% of what he says on this, but even he's missed this one, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is functionally unsustainable, right? But that particular apocalypse does assume that a lot of people are doing what I'm doing, right? Which is not necessarily the case.
No, but it is going to balloon because some of what's going on with these AI stuff coming out, because like you say, Silicon Valley's kind of sitting back a bit. You know, we've got the LLM as a product. No one's got a killer app. Everyone's trying to produce killer apps. So lots of people are stepping into this space, and the way these models are being released via the chat interface into the world, you know, really has enabled a whole layer of people to enter into the game, you know, because effectively, you know, you're prompt engineering, if you want to call it that, building out prompts just to, and from that you can get, you know, decent results. And as you say, how much the code is neither here nor there, really, because as long as it's doing what you want, and if it's not, change the prompt, it starts doing something different. And so there's a lot of people stepping into that. Everyone's hoping that someone's going to come up with something. But it does make you feel that that's going to release more and more software. I mean, it's not going to be everybody. These things never are everybody. But I don't know if it's similar to, you know, what we've seen in kind of television viewing, you know, and many different things, is the fractionalization going from, you know, mass media, one broadcasting company broadcasting long programs, now down to, you know, 10 seconds on TikTok, which might go out to a few thousand people, but those few thousand people really, really like that stuff. And so there's possibly some monetization possibilities with that. And then we've even gone through that cycle, and then you get this individualization, then itself becomes massive. So somebody goes from being popular with 10,000, then suddenly they're popular with 100 million, like Mr. Beast or something. And so there's this kind of, you know, which we've always seen in software, you swing from the sort of the centralized to the decentralized, the fractionalization. Those small ones, that fractionalization then, you know, it breaks the monolith, but then you're very small, and then those small things become popular. So you now build a new monolith, albeit that rather than being built around the ability to broadcast a program, that monolith is now built around, oh, well, everyone likes watching this sort of content, you know, and so Mr. Beast now is, you know, he's trying to get a billion subscribers or whatever on YouTube, which is kind of like, you know, where the people like the BBC and national broadcasters were. But it's just born out of a very different, you know, the starting point is we all love his stuff, and that's what we're all subscribing. And I guess at some point that becomes the monolith that then breaks for whatever reason. It then fractionalizes, goes down to the smallest atomic amount, and then rebuilds up again. It sort of feels like that's where we're at here. You know, we've had the really big monolithic software. I mean, well, first of all, we're sort of in the 70s and 80s when software was being built. Then the internet came along and fractionalized everything. And then that got built on and built up against. Now you've got your Metas and Googles and your big corporate software, SAP and Microsoft. And now perhaps that's all going to be fractionalized again. And then no doubt those fractions and atoms will build up again to a new monolith, which I guess is probably the cycle we're on at the moment. I'm not sure whether we're still breaking down or whether we're building up yet. But
well, I mean, I think that's exactly the point, isn't it? Is that there is a lot of AI boosters out there that would like everyone to think that they're already in a new paradigm, right? Mm. And it's absolutely clear to anyone paying any attention that we're still transitional, right? And
yeah,
how long this transitional phase will last and where it will transition to, there is so little idea. And I don't know. I can try and rewind myself back to dot-com times. I was working for Amazon the year 2000, and then lastminute.com after that. So my career started proper started in the dot-com boom, and it did. I'll tell you what, it didn't feel transitional, right? But but I think from an outside perspective, it probably did. And I think from the perspective of I started off in e-commerce, which was ultimately, you know, going to dominate for the next decade until the social media, the social web really kicked in. The thing is, right, the moment that the GPTs really started to look good, right, GPT-3 onwards, we're talking like 3 years ago now, right? The hype went up to dot-com level hype straight away, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the blueprint of what the next decade of the web was going to become was a lot more present, you know. I don't know, it's really hard to get my head around. It's like I can't remember, because actually the ramp-up to that started before I got into it, and the apex happened after I got into it, and I was sort of swept up by that wave. But like, so it's really hard to try and find the parallel here. But what's absolutely clear is that we are still transitional, right? And that I think that the real clout, the real payload here is going to come from a direction that people are not expecting, right?
Mm.
And I can't see that in the year 2000. I can't see that it wasn't obvious that e-commerce was going to be huge. No one was predicting social media, and that's absolutely fine, right? It was going to take another 10 years for that to really be made possible and to really figure itself out. And obviously that's run its course now as well. And as you said, it's become something different. Social media is now a replacement for TV, whereas it was a replacement for communication in the year 2010, right? So I'm also not saying that these things, you know, didn't mature and mutate, right? And that e-commerce didn't become, you know, who'd have predicted what Amazon was? Well, who would have predicted the existence of a company like Amazon that was providing the backbone for shipping infrastructure, would sell literally anything, and would also have a huge cloud server business, and we'd be running half the internet, right? So drawing a line from Amazon in the dot-com boom to where we are now, no one could have predicted that. But being able to sit where looking at Amazon and the other businesses that survived that at the time, I think you could say, no, e-commerce is it, right? E-commerce is going to become pretty big, right? I'm just not sure what anyone can point to now, right? What is the real use case for the internet in 2000? It's e-commerce and, to a degree, communication. What's the use case for AI? I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the crux here is, right? This is why I don't think it's quite the same.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I was trying to explain to a friend of mine recently who's not in this world at all and kind of said to me, mentioned a couple of things about AI and they're like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. And then there was the usual discussion of, oh, well, I tried it, did it on this, it was all right. And then it's a load of rubbish. So I've not used it for 6 months. And so I was talking about, so I talked a bit about personalized software and sort of interesting. I was making it up on the fly. And she was saying, well, what do you mean? I said, well, imagine you're at work, you do certain things on your system and you sort of do it every day, every week. And you've got a few quirks about how you do it. Imagine if you're like an agent that sits there and learns how you do it. And then rather than spending 20 minutes doing it, you just say, I'll do that. And it does it. And you're able to sort of build a little screen interface and, you put your colors on it and you use the language you want to use. Now, when the person who sits next to you does a very similar job, looks over at your computer, they're going, God, what's that? And you say, I'm just doing the name entry. Well, why is it blue? Well, how did you get that to happen? It's just going to look different. And then you look at their screen and say, well, what have you got? Well, I built mine like this. People won't even think of it as building. It would just be, well, I had the ability to customize my process. But because I think about it in this way, it looks and acts differently, but you're both doing the same job. And this is a little bit like, what you get served in your ad space. I look at yours and you look at mine, we go, God, we're getting pretty different ads. We're watching the same program, and I can see that's the way it's going. You start thinking about something like that, and I could see that as being, a way for the future. I don't think it particularly answers the question of, well, what's it for? I mean, the overall answer of that is, well, why have you got these different agents running on this software? Is, well, because it makes my job easier. And as we've talked about, I don't really care whether it's easier for you, as long as it's easier for me. And maybe that software dies the moment I move jobs and I don't do that anymore. But, where does that leave the corporation? Well, a bit of a problem with thousands more lines of software than it's ever had, probably have got to support, but really need to allow it to let it happen. Because if you don't, some other company is going to have an infrastructure that allows that to happen, and therefore their people are going to be doing just a little bit more than yours because they've got all these bits of software helping them out as they go along.
Well, and I think this does transition into the sort of the next topic, which is we've been very much talking about using AI to build a piece of software. But what are we using to do that now? Well, we're using agents to do that. And by agents, we mean pieces of software that sit on top of one or more AI models that can handle multi-step processes, right, and reason through them and handle novel situations among that. Yeah. And actually, interestingly, OCAT isn't agentic quite, but has AI built in. For example, when I want to add a task, it's actually been fielded by a model, right? So I can just use natural language, right? And there's various things it can do, like make updates and changes to the vector store and various other things, file system things, that I can just tell it in natural language what to do, right? And so I used an agent to build something that's somewhat agentic, right? And ultimately, I think if I keep building it out, it will become more and more agentic and probably would replace the agents that I already use, right? But what what I've done there is I've created sort of a productivity app using an agent. But when I think about it, the vast majority of my time using AI is using a command line agent, right? And is actually getting it to do things that either I don't want to do, I don't know how to do, or I don't have the time to do, right? And unless there's anything from, like I just used the agent recently, I used Warp Terminal Agent to open up an SSH channel through from my, I've got a web-facing cloud server, and I've got a an old gaming PC under my computer that I'm under my desk that I'm using as a file store, right? And I wanted that available in the air because it also runs OCAT for me. It runs my main instance of OCAT. So I wanted that opened up through the web using a reverse SSH tunnel from my internet facing server. I knew it could be done. I sort of vaguely knew how it was doing, but no, I just got the agent to do it, right? And it took no time, right? And so that's something that's quite technical. Most people won't think of or know exists or have any use case for. But a lot of the time, it's like, well, I've got a whole bunch of files here. Like I had it sort my photos into year buckets folders, right? Which anyone would want to do, right? and maybe I only need to do that once. Maybe I need to repeat it. And so I think, and you don't have to do things by the terminal, but I think this will bleed into my everything via the terminal mentality. And I'd like to explore that, not necessarily because I think it's something other people would necessarily want or need to adopt, is to understand why I'm doing it the way I'm doing it and how I think about that, right?
Yeah.
Because I think it's quite interesting, right? And so the details aren't that important. The philosophy, I think, deserves a better discussion, right? And because it's what it says about this new world, because I don't think I would be doing this were agentic AI not a thing, right? I would be doing bits of it, but not the whole thing. So I think that's another day.
Yeah, for sure.
But like, there is so much here. We, you know, there was a third topic we had on the list, which is broadly what if the models are as good as they're ever going to be, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is a huge question in its own right. So, and I want to cover that as well. And my brain is exploding from just the stuff we've covered here and the fact that we've sort of only scratched the surface. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So much so.
It's huge.
So much coming down the line.
Yeah. Well, yes. And there is potentially a fourth subject here, which is, let's assume that everything we're saying has some validity and that everyone's going to be, you know, AI coding their pants off, right, and using agents left, right, and center. Anyone who's been paying attention will know that the price is going to have to go up of inference.
Yes.
Right? Despite the fact they say it's coming down, I think these companies are making a massive loss and investors need their money back, right? Where's that going to come from? Well, it's going to have to come from putting prices up. So in the world where we have been discussing, what does that look like if prices go up by 10 times?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the apocalypse. There's always an apocalypse to end an episode with, isn't it? It's not exactly a good day if you haven't conceived of a new apocalypse, in my mind. Well, it's been lovely,
yeah,
Pete. And so try not to have any apocalypses, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
Cheers.
The Confusion Matrix.